LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement. The Supreme Court will hear a huge affirmative action case in their next term and with a brand new justice to boot. It's race preferences down the line and Avenatti versus Stormy Daniels on this week's Uprising. With Tim Donner back for the full show, here we go.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
If we were in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage and I can see through these guys.
Welcome back to the Uprising. Mr. Timothy Elting Donner, Uprising, the LibertyNation.com senior political analyst.
Oh, yeah. Okay, it gets longer every week. I see what you did there. I see what you did.
And lots to analyze today about the Supreme Court.
You know, a lot of people watching that, Scott, would think that you got a freeze frame, that he froze for a moment. I better switch away because there's obviously technical problems with this podcast. Anyway.
Lots to analyze this
proceed,
week.
Proceed, counselor.
About the Supreme Court decision, Breyer's decision to leave and the upcoming battle for sure. But there was a big case that the Supreme Court agreed to take before we get to the Breyer situation this week, which I thought was going to be the big judicial news, is that the Supreme Court has decided to take an affirmative action in higher education cases. In fact, two, they merged them into one. Students for, it's killing me that I'm going to miss this. Hold on. Let me get the actual.
Students in favor of virtue. Wasn't that?
It was something.
Yes. I'm trying to help you out here, counselor.
Yeah, I appreciate it. By the way, I wrote about it and I emailed with the guy who's like head of the organization, and you think I would, hold on just uno segundo.
Okay, let me give you some other shots in the dark. Students against tyranny. No, not that.
All right.
Students against socialism.
So no. There was a case. I'm actually going to cut all that anyway.
Geez, that's some of my best material.
There was a case that the Supreme Court decided to accept for their next sitting, basically in the fall. I'll just say it after Breyer's successor is confirmed, which is going to be an interesting angle to it. It's Students for Fair Access is this guy, Ed Blum or Bloom. And he's like a one man wrecking crew. You know, I'm always fascinated by these people who are like, they set out, they call their shot. We talked about it with Ted Cruz or I talked about it with Ted Cruz a week or two ago. They see an issue and they think that they're going to be able to get it before the Supreme Court, and they do it, you know, they take the seed, they germinate it, and they grow it, and they bear some fruit at the highest level. So this guy, Ed Blum, he's behind that Shelby County voting issue thing that animated all that hullabaloo over the laws and the filibuster. And here he goes again. He started a number of lawsuits, really all the big schools he sued, because they massively discriminate against whites and Asians in favor of black and brown people. That's just how they do. And they couch it in, you know, I was having a.
I appreciated, by the way, just to say, I appreciated in your writing about this, how you kept referring to it factually as discrimination against whites and Asians. In other words, this isn't something that we sort of perceive or whatever. It's actual discrimination against Asians and whites.
Well, I'm glad you made that point.
And it should be labeled that.
Yeah, that's so. The funny thing is, Tim, what they'll say is what the universities say is that no, we don't discriminate against anybody on the basis of the race. It's just a plus factor. It's like
we discriminate in favor of certain factors.
Well, yeah. Here's the thing: if I say like. you know, if there's a woman who says that she doesn't have a minimum. Well, now I'm going to get in trouble with that example, so I'm not going to use it. Let's just say this: if you say that you're using only one thing as a plus factor, but every single time it weighs in favor of that factor, well, then it's not just a plus factor, right? It's and the other thing too is the degree to which that factor is considered is massive. So, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the med school admissions is the easiest one to go by because they're published. And you can see that, you know, you would think like, oh, well, yeah, maybe they just want to take some people for the sake of having a well-rounded class. And, you know, it's good to have somebody from the inner city as well as a rural experience and whatever to round it. No. What happens is it would be like having a massive increase on your LSAT or SAT or a full GPA, a point added to your GPA to have the preferred race. So the last time the Supreme Court ruled on in a landmark fashion race in college admissions was a case called Grutter v. Bollinger. It was about the University of Michigan. And at that time, Justice Thomas was not speaking on the court. That was before he found his voice. But he wrote a beautiful dissent to that case. And what he said was that it denigrates everybody, you know, especially including the people who it's supposed to help, this idea of affirmative action. I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that and see that with this Breyer replacement, by the way.
You can't help but be struck by the juxtaposition of this affirmative action case coming before the court and perhaps having a very significant ruling, by the way, just as they may have a significant ruling on abortion in general and Roe versus Wade specifically. But the juxtaposition of that against Joe Biden actually practice openly as president of the United States, expressing open discrimination by saying that he will limit.
Well, yeah, we're gonna talk about that.
Right.
It's just
the irony about that in just a minute. Engaging in the kind of discrimination just as that case comes before the court.
But,
I mean, that's
but before we do, I want to get into the mechanics of the discrimination that has been allowed. What the Supreme Court said was that even though racial discrimination is like the worst possible thing you can do, basically, in every instance, we're going to allow it here because of this compelling need to discriminate. And I just thought that, again, before Justice Thomas found his voice on the court, back then, Justice Scalia was the guiding light for conservatives looking for some help at oral argument. Let's listen to him for a second in the Grutter v. Bollinger case.
Ms. Mahoney, I find it hard to take seriously the state of Michigan's contention that racial diversity is a compelling state interest, compelling enough to warrant ignoring the Constitution's prohibition of discrimination on the basis of race. The reason I say that is that the problem is a problem of Michigan's own creation. That is to say, it has decided to create an elite law school. It is one of the best law schools in the country, and there are a few state law schools that get to that level. Now, it's done this by taking only the best students with the best grades and the best SATs or LSATs, knowing that the result of this will be to exclude, to a large degree, minorities. It's not unconstitutional to do that, because that's not the purpose of what Michigan did, but it is the predictable result. Nonetheless, Michigan says, we want an elite law school. Now, having created this situation by making that decision, it then turns around and says, oh, we have a compelling state interest in eliminating this racial imbalance that we ourselves have created. Now, if Michigan really cares enough about that racial imbalance, why doesn't it do, as many other state law schools do, lower the standards, not have a flagship elite law school? Solves the problem.
Well, the thing is, you can't really disagree with his logic on any of that in terms of discrimination. Discrimination is discrimination, no matter who it favors or for what reason it's done. The problem is, Scott, in the real world, and I ask you this question as a college graduate like I am, would
I have distinguished myself with an undergraduate degree, Tim, before I achieved my graduate degree. That's right. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to go into comparative GPAs or anything like that, because I don't actually know which of us that would favor. But the point is, OK, so if you were basing your admission strictly on SAT scores and academic achievement and the like, you would likely have at a place like, let's take Yale University, you'd likely have a student body composed 98%, maybe 99% Asian and white. Okay, so here's my, this is a subjective objection to the idea that all affirmative action is inappropriate. And that is, would you have liked to go to college in a place where the only people you experienced during those college years were either people who were just like you or were really smart Asians? I mean, honestly, would that, how would that, you would have no, if you, what if you had almost no Black people or Hispanic people or Native Americans, people of different, you know, different Caucasians from different backgrounds as your own? Isn't that, or is that an appropriate consideration in the creation of a diverse student body at a place where, unlike
I think
world,
it's a more powerful argument in the undergraduate context than in the graduate
right.
school context.
I agree with that. Yes.
Because of the sort of building of the
yes.
whole person that,
absolutely.
You know, that occurs. And so maybe you can make a colorable case there. I can tell you my my cousin, who is a white female, Caucasian female, went to a large university's. She's one of the few white women engineer. I forget what kind of engineer she is, but she's the kind where she was the only white lady in the program. And it was all mostly Asian men. And, you know, She figured it out. You know, she got through it. It's not that big a deal. I can tell you, by the way, I wanted to just circle back to your you know, referencing my undergraduate experience and my GPA, for instance, just to give you an idea, Tim, of the insidiousness and elevation of the unearned by these. And I don't blame anybody who takes advantage of the programs, by the way.
Right.
I'm blaming the administrators exclusively.
Right.
Okay. But my undergraduate GPA and law school admission test score was such that I did not apply to the Yale University School of Law, which was, it's arguable, but people suggest it is the number one program in the country now. And at the time I applied to law school, and I didn't send in an application to Yale because why waste $50 on something that's just going to give the admissions committee a giggle as they toss my application into the trash, because I don't measure up to the other applicants. But if I were a Black man, Tim, I would have been admitted to Yale with a scholarship. That's the level. So the level of plus factor for the race. I just to give it a real put a
but
real
I think
point
you, you know I think you
the
make
plus
a more
factor
important.
For the race is the difference between laughing at an application and throwing it in the trash and saying, give me let's get this guy on the horn. We got to get him up here for a personal visit. Let's carpet for this.
Yeah,
guy.
I think you drew the best distinction, most important distinction between undergraduate and graduate, because people that go to undergraduate school, they go there partly for the experience and the exposure to people that are unlike them, to people from other places and races. But at graduate school, they're not going there for that. You're right. And so, I mean, you can't really argue against that a Scalia 90-second basically primer on affirmative action. But I, what do you think happens, broadly speaking, not on the hard left? Because I think we've spoken about, like with abortion, that if Roe v. Wade gets overturned, that creates an incredible energy on the left because of what a right that they feel they've lost. But do you think there'd be any energy, serious energy, in the general population behind?
No.
Supporting, standing behind affirmative action like 50 years later?
There's plenty of support. Listen, we had, I don't have the results of the poll it was a poll. Boy, it was maybe 6 months ago about the number of Caucasians and Asians who lie and manufacture some minority status for their applications, which is so funny, by the way. And it just tells you, gee, is it, talk about an argument against the kind of racist society. If you're willing to lie to say that you're a member of that class, is that really indicative
that's
of
what that's what you know? That's what it's come to.
Yeah. Oh, it's is a massive, massive plus factor. And people know about it. And I think that there's, you know, on the real progressive rabid side, there's no, you know, there's an unlimited appetite for discrimination against whites and Asians as well. But I think for the mom and pop, you know, Joe Scranton Democrat, they see the lie and it actually is felt. They understand that, you know, there are opportunities being lost because
it's important to point out. It's important to point out that it is not even so much Black people or Hispanic people or Asian people or whatever who are trying to press this agenda of neo-affirmative action, for lack of a better term. It's white progressives. It's white progressives whose vision of the way society should be is entirely different than normal people, Black, white, and every race, creed, and color. Progressives.
Affirmative action's
normal.
Biggest beneficiary has been white women of a certain age. That is, and just in terms of the broad strokes, you know, it's Elizabeth Warren who who gets it.
That's absolutely true. But I think it's important to point that out, that it is white progressives who will continue this regime, they'll be the only ones. I sort of answering my own question here. They'll be the only ones who will be out there arguing about the cruelty of ending affirmative action. Because I bet you won't have a ton of Black people other than Al Sharpton and others. And it's just like on the issue of voting rights, Scott, where white progressives are pushing for the full federalization of elections with almost no voter ID required, mail-in required, universal mail-in voting. It's white progressives who are demanding an end to voter ID because Black people, Scott, when they're polled on this, I'm not going to give you the exact percentage, but I'm in the neighborhood. 70%+ of Black people believe that there should be voter ID. It's white progressives who want to get rid of it.
Well, that I think that actually has something to do with in terms of like the sort of the war between the races, if you will. They see that the more the illegal immigrant class gets to come in, they're going to get the spoils from the Democrat Party. And what happens is that group becomes so large that they don't have to pay attention to Blacks because they no longer need their votes. And so they lose a massive amount of political power in that regard.
Well, and that's why their paternalistic instincts work very well with new waves of immigrants, for example. Because they can take them under their wing and say, we'll protect you and we'll demand that you get your rights. And, you know, again, it's these white progressives a whole lot more than some uprising among Black people, just like the summer of 2020, where the left was trying to burn down the country. It wasn't. Yeah, there were a lot of Black people involved, but it was white progressives who made it possible, who stoked it, who advanced it, and who allowed its continuation.
So the other thing is, and this I think is really the what just should animate everybody to want to extinguish affirmative action. If you go to that Yale Law School class, for instance, that I would have been a scholarship recipient for rather than laughed out of the building to try to become a member of, if you are the black person who earned your spot in that class, right, by having the stellar undergraduate GPA and having the intellectual horsepower to perform at a super, super high level on the LSATs and have all the extracurriculars and everything else to earn your slot, like every white and Asian who didn't have a parent who graduated from there could write a check to fund a new wing, I guess, or whatever. I'm mindful that there are other preferences that don't include merit.
Are you talking legacy, Scott?
Well, Tim, to a person of your of your breeding and stature,
I'm so gracious, Scott, that I set myself up to be slapped ingraciously in the face.
I didn't want to.
That's how gracious I am.
What it does is it takes away from that person, because anybody who knows how big that racial preference is likely to think that they earned that slot because of their race. And this, I think, is actually a great segue into Justice Breyer's retirement and the talk of who may replace him. There is a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, often called the second highest court in the land. It's a feeder ground for Supreme Court justices. And it's where Kavanaugh came from, for instance, among many others, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ketanji Brown Jackson, I believe, is the woman's name. And
Jackson would have to be the odds-on favorite at this point.
Well, I think she's the favorite, but so my point is she actually fits into this category, I believe. In other words, I have no reason to believe that she didn't earn her. She was a Harvard law grad. She was Ted Cruz's classmate at Harvard, as a matter of fact. But when I hear her and see her work, it doesn't seem to be that of an also-ran. Like, so just for the record, Justice Sotomayor is an also-ran. She is a trash justice who is a second-rate mind.
How about Kagan?
Oh, no, she has the goods. Absolutely.
And how about Breyer?
Same, you know. By the way, I have...
So you're saying, just to summarize, you're saying two of the three liberal justices were really respectable judges.
Well, they weren't elevated because of their race, Tim, unlike Justice Sotomayor, who was elevated because of her
race. And so you're saying that you don't believe Justice Sotomayor has the intellectual heft?
It's not
to
just
be
me.
A justice?
I mean, who does?
I'm just asking you.
Yes, sir. She is. Okay. Oh, no, she's, you know.
Well, the reason I ask you this.
I don't expect a Democrat, Tim, to, or even a Republican for that matter, with my beliefs, to elevate somebody as justice or nominate somebody as justice who I agree with. But damn, I expect them to be smarter than I am and have worked harder and have a better legal career than me, you know. And it's like, that is true for all those people, by the way, with the exception of Justice Sotomayor. She never says anything or has a thought that I think, oh, wow, that, you know.
I think she forever disgraced herself with her comments about vaccines that were so just staggeringly incorrect.
Yeah. See, okay, let me just stop you right there, because I don't agree with you. And here's why I don't agree with you on that point. That was just an error of fact. Anybody can make an error of fact. I mean, her analysis and her.
But her whole analysis,
that's
her
where the
whole
weakness in her mind is
based. Her analysis was based on those false facts in upholding the vaccine mandate. She based her opinion on the sense we have still an overwhelming pandemic that's overwhelming the country. And that wasn't true.
She also behaves in a manner and a political manner that if she were on the right, I mean, they would be marching in the streets. There was a piece in, I forget who publishes her, but Jane Mayer wrote one of her famous hit pieces. This time it was against Virginia Thomas, who was Justice Clarence Thomas's wife, who is a very politically active person and was before she even met Justice Thomas. Okay. Yes. He was not Justice Thomas then. He was just
and
Clarence.
It happens to be white.
She's a white lady, but so she's Catholic too. She's a very politically active person and has continued to be. And the painting of it is that somehow her political activism taints Justice Thomas's judgments, which I think is so funny from the left, because you could imagine, Tim, if there was the opposite were true, right? Like that somehow a woman should stay silent for her own her own advocacy of politics because of her husband's job. Isn't that the whole part of the whole women's rights movement and liberation, that she's entitled to her own opinions and actions?
Didn't Hillary talk about she could have spent her years baking cookies and having teas?
Yeah.
I mean, look, I think
I'm not some Tammy Wynette, stand by your man, right?
Here's the thing. If I'm a progressive here, and now, of course, just like with Kamala Harris for VP, who herself is putatively a candidate for the court, Joe Biden has boxed himself into a tiny little corner by saying he's going to appoint only a woman of color. Well, actually, he doesn't even say that. He says black woman, which means you have to be fully black, which means, I suppose, a Hispanic is out. So
you're not only that.
Just to finish the point, you know, it seems to me that what's missing in the progressive bloc is not just Ruth Bader Ginsburg as that fourth vote, but RBG as sort of the leader of that pack. Now, I don't know that she ever merited the kind of adulation that she attracted on the left. I never saw opinions from her that were, you know, striking.
Yeah.
But she was perceived as someone that animated the left.
She was a standard bearer.
The sort of standard bearer. They don't have that now. Breyer's not that. Sotomayor isn't that. And Kagan seems very much in the background, especially as part of a 6-3 minority. So if I'm a progressive, or I'm just a liberal, or I'm just a Democrat, I would want someone here who can be a forceful advocate for the liberal interpretation of the Constitution, because they're missing that since RBG left. And I fear for them, if I was them, that the choices they have, which interestingly, by the way, include a South Carolina judge she's a South Carolina judge who's a sister of Stacey Abrams.
I want someone who's a forceful advocate. By the way, just for people who may have thought about this, it's been on Twitter and social media. People were talking about Kamala Harris as a candidate, and I can tell you that that's not going to happen. And the reason why it's not going to happen is because forget about any politics on the right, and forget about any of the million statements that Kamala Harris has made on issues about things that will come up before the court, like abortion and guns and whatever else. She is an intellectual lightweight. And like, people on the right rose up against Harriet Myers, who's a woman who was George Bush's White House counsel's office personnel.
That was a
lawyer that he liked. Yeah. And I have no understanding of her as being an incompetent lawyer or anything like that. She seemed to be perfectly competent, but also was not at the high levels of the legal profession where the pools of these people are drawn from. And the credentialists and academics who revere the Ivy League law schools and the high rank, like Kamala Harris has a second rate law degree.
You know what, though? Okay.
She's never
practiced. You're right, Scott, but I think you're advancing an argument that's outdated, because I think the only thing the left cares about these days is a firm vote. And you know what? Listen to me.
I'm just telling you, it ain't going to happen. She's not going to be nominated.
Well, probably not. But the larger point you're making is that they need someone with intellectual heft and all that. And I say balderdash. There's a good Joe Biden type turn from the 1950s, Scott, balderdash, because what they've always done well that the right has not done well is to pick people that they can 100% rely on to advance the ball in the direction they want. The Republicans have picked people like Souter, right? And Earl Warren, who they projected might be what they want and would satisfy a broad coalition, bipartisan.
Well, as I recall, John Sununu promised Bush
But that was still a projection, right?
Yeah.
And so what the left has always done well is pick people who they could count on, who were not going to go rightward, whereas the right has picked many have picked several, including John Paul Stevens and David Souter, and most famously Earl Warren, who headed leftward in a way that changed the course of history, Scott. So I think that really the left just wants someone who they're sure will be in their corner 100%. Does it really matter in this state of a divisiveness, a civil war of ideology that we're under, whether the person has any intellectual heft or not?
I think it does. The court, the Senate is evenly divided, and they want it to go, you know, without a hitch. In fact, you know, one of the things I think to mention, and I want to play a clip of, is it KBJ or KJB? I'm going to have to get used to this. If she's the nominee, I promise I'll remember. It's KBJ, Ketanji Brown Jackson. And Justice Breyer, he's one of these justices who cautions against, you know, the politicizing the court. And it's not about the politicization of these issues. But yet he times his retirement. Why and how, Tim? Precisely to benefit the Democrats in order to replace him.
All right. But of course, what's come out is that Breyer is really pissed that somebody.
Oh, yeah. But before we get to that,
because he might have waited months to say it.
He might have waited months to say it publicly. He told the White House last week. The point is, he made his decision to tell the White House last week. Why, Tim? For the political purpose of them getting their ducks in a row.
It's so that obvious.
For political reasons, okay?
It's because of the fact that RBG refused to do that has cost them control of the court.
And my point is not that a justice shouldn't do that. My point is just that anytime Breyer would say about the non-political stuff, he should have been laughed out of the freaking building by anybody who was within earshot, because he is a damn hypocrite on the issue. Ultimate and total hypocrisy on that issue. So, but I don't begrudge it if anybody says it openly. Like, yeah, there's a certain, I think, value of saying, hey, you dance with the one who brung you, you know, and it's appropriate for him to look at the landscape politically and say, I want to make sure that Democrats.
And I think, look, there's political parties and then there's causes. And that's where there is a sort of synchronicity between political parties and individuals that sit on the court who hold political views themselves, even if they're not sort of allowed to project them. But we all know, you know, how that goes. And so, you know, a guy like Breyer, you know, he comes onto the court and he does basically what he's supposed to do, right? I mean, he's basically sort of taking orders without having to take orders. There's no need for either side to tell their friendly justices, so to speak, the position that they favor. Now you're getting some independence from people like Neil Gorsuch, particularly. He's written a couple of opinions that have inflamed certain conservative interests.
We don't speak ill of Neil on
right,
but, and it's but Justice Gorsuch to you, sir. But on his program, yeah.
But here's the point. He has demonstrated some independence. I haven't seen that independence on the left. I haven't seen, you know, we've seen whole justices like Souter.
I think you're wrong, Tim, to think about it as we don't see that they're independent. I think that they just. It goes back to what you said before, which is they put up these people who—that's their true belief system. In other words, Justice Breyer, he's never going to vote for allowing, you know, the gun rights to be as recognized right. as abortion
even
rights.
He didn't even get a memo on that.
It's in every fiber of his being.
Yeah.
By the way, I wanted to make a point earlier and I didn't get a chance to, so I just want to say it now, just in terms of the universe. And I wrote about this for the sponsor of today's podcast, LibertyNation.com, your source for conservatarian news and analysis 24/7, 365, that the racial kind of component of the justice pick and the sexualized component has to be a African-American woman. Well, two things. Number one, or black woman, as you say, that Biden said, one of the big things for this kind of like race war spoils system is that it's important that the person be a descendant of American slavery, which is why another reason why Kamala Harris doesn't fit. And a lot of folks don't fit into that mold, but there are.
Yeah, but that would allow Biden to get rid of Kamala Harris. Don't you see? That's the big thing that's going here.
It ain't going to happen. But let me make my point, which is there are 1.3
with one stone.
There are 1.3 million lawyers in the country. And while you don't have to be a lawyer.
Is that all?
it seems like about
10 Sorry, times yeah, that yeah. amount.
Well, that's how dangerous we are. So there's 1.3 million lawyers in the country. And again, you don't have to be a lawyer to be, you know, there's no constitutional requirement that they are. But practically speaking, you have to be a lawyer to be nominated, you know, sort of successfully in the body politic. And there are 22,000 and change Black women lawyers. Now, those are numbers that are from the American Bar Association, not my numbers. You just see what the difference in the talent pool is. Okay, I can pick from 1.3 million over here,
yeah,
or I can pick from 22,000 over here. What are the odds that the best person for the job is going to come? Oh, I see you want to talk, but just wait a second.
Well, it's the same thing as he did with a vice presidential pick. Same thing.
Yeah. Well, here's, by the way. OK, so now we'll turn to your political analysis for a second. I thought this would have been the strongest political move Biden could have made. He could have said, no. I've decided instead to just pick the best person for the job instead of restricting it that way. And then, Tim, then come up with the exact same nominee, come up with Ketanji Brown Jackson and say, she's the nominee, not because of her sex, not because of her race, but because she's the highest qualified candidate. And I think she's going to do the best job for the American people.
Sure.
Voila. Here's our nominee.
But that makes the point, you know, because I think most politicians would have done that. But this guy is so ham-handed, so clueless, lacks any spark of creativity, never thinks outside of the small little establishment box of reality, looks at things strictly by what he has to do politically to satisfy some outraged minority base. And let me say this, because I don't believe that Kamala Harris is going to be the choice. But he could certainly kill three birds with one stone. He could get rid of a woman who incredibly, and this is hard to do, is even more unpopular than him. Number two, he could start from scratch and pick someone who they really want to run in 2024, because Biden can't run again. And number three, he could satisfy the idea of putting a Black woman on the court, all three in one.
Not a black woman, according to the Stacey Abramses of the world. Not according to me, right?
I think even Biden might be willing to consider that acceptable. But of course, he's controlled. But Biden's not even his own man. He's not even he's controlled by the far left of his party. When they say jump, he says how high. And that's why he's gotten into trouble, because he supported stuff that the American people are against, and he's pushed it to the wall, even when he was certain he was going to lose. But I got a question for a constitutional question for you. Here you go. Not that I think Kamala Harris is going to be the choice, but if she was, is there anything in the United States Constitution that would prevent a vice president from simultaneously serving as a justice on the Supreme Court?
I think to answer that question, you would have had to pose it to me before the show, so I could have read the Constitution with that question in mind.
See, I haven't found anything. I did not do a deep, exhaustive search, but I did not find anything on the surface and slightly below that would actually exclude that possibility. Now, I'm not saying he's going to do that.
The other thing
out of the box, but
the other thing is, then you'd really get into issues of recusal. That would blow up the court in a different way.
Yes, it would.
But the other thing is, in a sort of standard, so that there's no danger of that. I don't want to get too, that's a little bit too far afield for us for now.
To have fun
but with. The other thing is, she wouldn't take the job, Tim. Okay. She gets to, you know, let's think of the two existences that she has. And the one existence, even in her made fun of, you know, everybody, you know, it seems like the tide is turning against her, right? She gets to be a queen, right? She gets to walk around and have a court and security and fly around on fancy airplanes and not have to wait in traffic.
Right, Scott,
whatever.
For four more years.
Well, by the way, she doesn't think it's for four more years. She thinks it's for 16 more years.
Yeah, well.
Or okay. Wait, 12 more years. No, wait. 12 plus 3 is 15 more years.
You know, she may not be a two-termer. Scott, she may not be a deep thinker. But she can look at numbers. She can see herself at 26% approval.
Hold on. I wasn't done my analysis.
As a Supreme Court justice, you get treated like a queen for the rest of your life. You're never subject to election or ridicule.
You don't get to make all that do-re me. Like she's going to be able to make by selling speeches to Goldman and whatever else. Not the level that Hillary Clinton made, right? But she is going to be a hit on the lecture circuit. She's a hero. The first woman of color is a whatever. And all that cash, you can't make that on the Supreme Court. And here's the other thing. You got to read the briefs. You got to go to the hearings. You got to do the work. Okay. You think she wants to do all that? That's actually, you know, burdensome. She doesn't want that job. She wants to go laugh and giggle on some, you know, that cackle's not going to go.
You have a bunch of clerks do the reading for you and give you one page summary, Scott, not hard.
All right.
We'll leave the Kamala Harris. I have one more outlandish thing. And the only reason I can do it is because this is a podcast.
Go ahead.
Podcasts are designed to bring up stuff like this. So here's one idea that I saw one writer bring up. The best person to nominate, given the current state of play in the Democratic Party, and their abject fear, especially given Biden's growing weakness, their abject fear of a return of the authoritarian, evil dictator Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Put Trump on the court, then he can't run for president. And he's got liberal views on a lot of social issues. Put him on the court, then he can't run for president.
That's too ridiculous for me to respond to, except to reiterate... My solution for the left to get rid of Donald Trump's political aspirations, which is you get whoever the hell's in charge of Twitter now that Jack Dorsey left, and you give Trump the deal. We'll give you the keys to your Twitter back if you promise not to run for president. I think it's a deal he will go for.
Are you kidding?
And
you think he'll give up running for president to get his Twitter account?
I do actually think that's true. Yes.
I'll put money on that for you. But honestly, he wants to be president, Scott. Twitter's just a means to an end.
We will focus on
they're calling him in inner circles, they're calling him 47 now.
Yeah, great. That and $2 will get you a cup of coffee.
Just saying.
We will focus on the nominees the nominee when they become available, but just right now it is KBJ who's the favorite. And I just thought this was an interesting clip. I did start kind of researching her previous, because I hadn't been focused on her previously as a judge. And I just started looking at some of her previous confirmation stuff. And I thought this was an interesting clip.
What role does race play, Judge Jackson, in the kind of judge that you have been and the kind of judge you will be?
Thank you, Senator. I don't think that race plays a role in the kind of judge that I have been and that I would be in the way that you ask that question. As I mentioned to Senator Feinstein, I'm doing a certain thing when I get my cases. I'm looking at the arguments, the facts, and the law. I'm methodically and intentionally setting aside personal views, any other inappropriate considerations. And I would think that race would be the kind of thing that would be inappropriate to inject in my evaluation of a case. I would say that my different professional background than many of the Court of Appeals judges, including my district court background, which will be different if I'm confirmed than many of my colleagues, would bring value. It's sort of like the Oliver Wendell Holmes quote that the life of the law is not logic, it's experience. And so I've experienced life in perhaps a different way than some of my colleagues because of who I am. And that might be valuable. I hope it would be valuable if I was confirmed to the court, the circuit court.
I wouldn't expect her to say anything different than that. I mean, and just the fact that she's on the highest court in the land outside of the Supreme Court, she's on the D.C. appellate, gives her a big hand up. But I will say this, one of the things that I picked up in looking at possible successors, and you laughed at the sister of Stacey Abrams.
Yes.
But she's being considered. One of the advantages that she has.
Seriously, come on.
Well, look, you can evaluate the relative merits of these judges. You've got district judges that are being considered, which certainly shouldn't give them as much advantage.
They will not nominate a district judge. I can tell you that right now. I mean, that's my political analysis. You don't take somebody from the JV squad and give them a full ride to college. They got to put the varsity time in before you do it. That's your sports analogy.
Mr. Donald. Sure. But I would say that Abrams' sister, apparently, according to Jim Clyburn, Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott, the two senators from South Carolina, have already committed to support her if she is nominated. So what I'm saying is, if you bring up Judge Jackson from the D.C. appellate court and the Republicans feel in a mood to retaliate for what was done to Brett Kavanaugh, they could give her an awfully hard time, and they could hold out every single vote, and they could force Kamala Harris to cast a tie-breaking vote and bring down the hell and fury on her. Go with someone like Abrams, I think that, you know, they will have at least two Republican votes. And so it's a matter of, do they want someone with a little more, who's more credentialed and with more heft, or whether they want someone who they could get through more easily?
All right. Well, look, I thoroughly disagree with everything that you just said. And let me lay out why. Okay. KBJ.
Well, I put it as a question. Wait a minute, though. I put it as a question. I didn't say.
All right.
I said
don't
that.
Don't be so defensive, okay?
This would all right. make it easier.
Hear my analysis about why I think that's a bad way to think about it. KBJ is a better choice for the Republicans. She is an academic. She is a esteemed judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. She's not this kind of political mover. I mean, anybody who's at that level has to be a political mover.
Yeah, but so was Brett Kavanaugh. So was Brett Kavanaugh.
Just hear me out. So if you are a Republican who wants good decisions from the court and good decision making, you actually want the best of the left that they can give you, right? In other words, you're not going to get a Scalia, Thomas, Gorsuch, whatever from a Biden nominee. So you want a high quality judge. And here's what I'm going to tell you, Tim, the lawyers, the Republican lawyers on the Judiciary Committee, there's a huge difference to them between Judge Abrams, if that's her name. I don't know if she's got a married name that's different or not, but
married name. Yeah.
And KBJ. Who is respected. And the other thing, too, is we have a history in this country, at least in my lifetime and perhaps even before, whereby Republicans give Democrats their nominees unless there's some profound issue with them, where they, you know, some discovery about a real character flaw.
Well, they may do that.
By and large, Republicans are like, yeah, they're going to get their nominees. So as long as they're not crazy loons,
But Scott, the Brett Kavanaugh fiasco, I think, changed everything, because that was so disgraceful. It was so unfair. It was so outrageous that, look, they may continue to do the, look, what does it matter? Give the left what they want. Person's going to be nominated anyway. We'll look big if we give them what they want. They might. But they might just as easily, Scott, exact revenge. And I mean, not just blind revenge, but they may really drill down on how far left this nominee is. Because you say, okay, look, you say you want the person with the greatest intellectual heft on the left, if you're a Republican. I think you might really want the opposite. You want the biggest lightweight that you can get, the person who can most easily be condemned. Mm. Because the question, if I'm a Republican, the question to me is not so much how intellectually qualified this new justice is, but how far to the left she really is in her true beliefs.
Tim,
is she a true socialist, or is she a moderate liberal?
Stacey Abrams is like a total freaking communist. If her sister's anything like her, there she's way left than Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Yeah, well, I don't know about Judge Abrams Elliott, I think is her name. I don't know about her actual judicial record, but the point is that I want someone who is more like Breyer than Sotomayor.
All right, so this is what I'm saying I'm disagreeing you with. Why wouldn't you think that Stacey Abrams' sister is orders of magnitude to the left of KBJ?
Oh, I'm not saying she isn't. What I'm saying is you're saying the chief criterion in Republicans looking at it should be how intellectual. Well,
it should be what's best for the country. I mean, honestly.
Right. You know, well, it should be. Of course, it always should be, but it never is. Okay. The point is, you're saying the chief criteria for Republicans looking at it, this should be how qualified is the person. And I'm saying the chief aspect that Republicans should be looking at is just how far to the left is she? Is she a Breyer or is she a Sotomayor? Because that makes a much bigger difference.
Yeah, I think that KBJ is a Breyer, and very likely Abrams' sister is a Sotomayor
would weigh more in favor. Yeah.
Well, you have unwittingly, Tim, once again produced a great segue for us, because we're going to talk about Michael Avenatti, who brought the chief wingnut accuser for Brett Kavanaugh. Let's go ahead and play.
To the individuals on the committee, like Mr. Grassley, to Donald Trump, and to his surrogates, I say this. You better be very, very careful before you come after my client and call her a liar or engage in some of the other despicable conduct that you've engaged in relating to Dr. Ford over the last 4 to 5 days, where you've had your surrogates go out and malign this woman for being brave and having the courage to come forward and literally risk her life and the life of her family as it relates to this search for the truth. You better be very, very careful if you come after my client, because you will be shown to be an absolute fraud. This woman is showing incredible courage and bravery, just like Dr. Ford, and she is going to tell the truth, and we're going to let the American public decide whether she is telling the truth.
Boy, it's hard to remember a time, you know, Michael Avenatti emerged Christ-like. For the militant atheist left as the for Donald Trump in all things, including his nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. And this is,
by the way, I got to ask you, though, point of information here, because I haven't been following it. What's happened to Michael Avenatti's presidential campaign?
So Avenatti's in the news this week, for people who don't know, because he's facing his second or third? It's hard to keep track.
I think it's third.
A federal criminal prosecution, this time for stealing.
You can, though. Let me just say, you were allowed to run for president from prison, I believe.
Democrat Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you.
Sure. You know, it's funny. I always have to say Democrat Lyndon LaRouche, not even to dump on the Democrats, but because he was a wingnut, a lot of people thought would try to pawn him off as a libertarian. So like in my earlier, much younger days as a kind of libertarian party activist sort, I'd go on these like signature campaigns and people would say like, aren't you running Lyndon LaRouche? And you're like, no, absolutely not. He's a libertarian, a Democrat.
He's such Lyndon LaRouche. He's such a kook. He must be a libertarian.
So anyway, that's perhaps an anachronism now to even reference Mr. LaRouche. But
yeah, but for anybody of your age or beyond, it's a definite laugh line.
So Avenatti is being charged with stealing from Stormy Daniels his you know, the ticket he was riding to fame and infamy to be the Trump slayer that he wanted to be. And she says he stole the money for her book advance and some legal defense fund he set up for her. And he says, basically, you know, I paid for your security and I flew around the country, you know, with all these lawsuits for you. And that's where the money went. And they're at trial now. And he fired his by the way, this tells you how far the mighty have fallen. Back when he was doing that, he was flying his own private jet around the country. And now he's got a public defender because of he's got no dough. So he fired his public defender, though.
It's just a crying shame. I'm so sorry.
He fired his public defender so that he could conduct his own trial and examine witnesses. And as we speak, actually, right now, on Friday morning at about 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, he is cross-examining Stormy Daniels. He did it a little bit yesterday too, and boy, he said he wants to have her on the stand for 6 hours, to try to sort of dig himself out of these charges. So
what struck me most about Avenatti when he went after Trump was the hubris of your profession, Scott. This guy thought that he could come out and take on not just the president of the United States, but Donald Trump when he was president, like that was going to end well for him. I mean, you didn't know how, but you knew it wasn't going to end well and that he wasn't going to be able, this corrupt lawyer wasn't going to be able to take down the most powerful man in the world.
The Avenatti is a really interesting case study, Tim. He was first in his class at GW Law School, which is, it's a decent law school.
Not as good as Villanova.
I wasn't going to say it, but thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
As the rankings go, by the way, the independent rankings, I think that they would disagree with you, by the way. So it is a high performing school. And he also worked for Rahm Emanuel's like opposition research efforts before law school and during. And he worked with Jonathan Turley while he was in law school on some issues. And he has, I think, four at least cases where he was in the dozens of millions for recovery for clients. Massive success there, and a lot of like working with celebrities too. Like he is, he's not just a guy who's like flash. He's got the heft to back it up.
Well, then it's too bad for him that his public image is that of a junk lawyer, because that's what people think he is.
Well, now, I mean, it's even worse than that. So he was convicted, by the way, and sentenced, I think, to 30 months in prison. I did write about this on the pages of LibertyNation.com, today's podcast sponsor, this is the kind of game he played. He had some information where he thought he could tarnish the Nike company it was like a deal where they paid coaches, I think high school coaches, to get their kids to wear Nikes and not Reeboks or whatever. And he thought he had them, like, basically he had the goods on them. So what does he do with the information? He goes to Nike basically and says, listen, hey, good thing it's me that found this out and not some other guy across the street. I'm going to help you out here. You hire me
right
as a special consultant for Nike to the tune of like, I don't know, some crazy $30 million. Or
I think it was $15 million, I think 15? Was the figure okay. as I recall it. Yeah.
We're going to help you out with this. We're going to keep it quiet, make sure it's not released. Or the alternative is I've got, and this is true. Like I've got the power to be on like four major networks within like, you know, 20 minutes of making a phone call basically. And when I talk about this, your stock price is going to drop 10X of what it would cost or even more than that, right? If you think your small drop in the stock price accrues to a great, much more than 15 million. That was the threat, and he basically executed the threat, and the Nike lawyer was like, FBI, we got this guy trying to extort us, and 30 months. So
it's called it's what they used to call a protection racket, and it's no different than a guy that goes into the Ma and Pa grocery store at the corner and says, you know, give me $50 and I'll make sure your store doesn't get torched. It's no different, and you would think that a guy like Avenatti would understand that a mega, mega corporation like Nike with virtually unlimited resources was going to put up with that. And here's the last question for you.
It wouldn't surprise me either way if they paid or not.
Yeah, but here's the last question for you. When was the last time you were on the side of Nike?
Yeah, right. Never. When I was in high school before they started.
But first time I looked for sneakers in the store.
Worshiping at the House of Jordan. I had a brief back and forth with LibertyNation.com's editor in chief who was talking about the piece I wrote about Daniels versus Avenatti sort of on the stand and was commenting that, you know, she didn't know who to like more or like less. In other words, is a piece where both parties are,
You know what it is, Scott? It's the Iran-Iraq war, where you want both sides to lose. The Iran-Iraq war.
I was thinking, Tim, I couldn't remember when it happened, but do you recall that I saw Ms. Daniels in Pittsburgh perform when it was the height of her infamy?
You went on a journalistic.
It was actually. I really was interested. Right. And by the way, just in terms of like the dirty games people play, the Republican pro-Trump police force leadership in Pittsburgh decided on the night of her performance there to institute like a check of the fire safety ratings of the club. And they raided the place. They filled it with cops in order to frustrate her performance. Clear violation.
You're blaming Trump.
Yeah. No. I'm blaming the actors in Pittsburgh who use their authority to punish her for her free speech. And I thought it was a disgusting display against her. And that is, I just that bring it night, up. As
that's
a,
right. That's right. I remember really that is. Was like, I think that was in 2018
probably
years ago
and I was just rereading some of the old pieces about her trying to recall the details of that raid and really how bad it was, because for me, for you know, as a free speech advocate, that's what really stood out as disgusting about it. But I recall, you know, it just kind of got lost in the shuffle, the whole thing. Why was she involved with, you know, the whole national political scene? It was just so that she could get out of, she took $130,000 to shut up about a night of sex that she had with Donald Trump. Okay. So he didn't have to answer questions.
Pretty
about
much that
it.
Simple.
Yep. And she wanted, when he became president on the eve of his presidency, she decided she could sell that story for a lot more than $130,000. So what did she do? She sued him. That's how she got started with Avenatti, to sue Trump to get out of the agreement and the money that she took so that she could sell her story for more money. And the premise of that suit, Tim, was that Donald Trump himself didn't sign the document, okay, because he wasn't in the room.
Right.
And that somehow violated what's called the statute of frauds, which is designed to protect the little person, by the way, from some big whatever of basically saying, well, you agreed to sell us your house. And even though, you know, you don't like the terms, well, there's no signature on it. So you can't go ahead with the enforcement of a contract provision. But she signed it and she never alleged that there was any fraud in it. It was just a workaround. The whole thing was just this basically based on an invented technicality so she could sell her tawdry story for more money.
And you know what? Here we are still talking about her 4 years later. She got what she wanted. She's world famous.
Yeah, I guess you're right. All right. I don't know where the lesson is there, but I think we'll put a pin in it. And of course, we'll be following I'll use the term advisedly, given the tone of our and topics, like white on rice. We'll be following the Breyer resignation and replacement. Thank you so much for coming back to the Uprising, Tim. Good to
Always
see you.
A pleasure. Great to be back and look forward to the weeks ahead.
Ciao.
Contributor for LibertyNation.com.
I think we're starting to make an impact. Liberty style. Fight for freedom.
I'll be tracking polls sponsored by Liberty Nation for Thursday.
Mentioned by Dan Bongino, Rasmussen, Jordan Peterson, and others.
I can do it again if you want me to.
Cited in Mark Levin's American Marxism.
I think we're starting to make a really big impact. Getting noticed. We're doing it. Rock on. I'm gone.